Welcome to the Deep Sea. Today we speak with Julie, Carson's mom. Carson is currently on his second leukemia relapse that Julie bravely and candidly describes her feelings and reactions to. She shares the entire range of emotions a parent goes through during treatment and relapse. And if you're ever really able to let your guard down after being pulled back into the cancer treatment world again and again, if your child is experiencing a relapse, or if you're stuck in the fear of cancer coming back, I think you'll deeply relate to our conversation today. My name is Sam Taylor. I'm the parent to a childhood cancer survivor and the host of the Deep Sea podcast, where we come together to talk to parents, caregivers, friends, and professionals who have been affected by childhood cancer. Hearing your child has been diagnosed can feel a lot like being ripped from life on land to suddenly being submerged deep into the ocean. It's disorienting, it's scary, and sometimes it's really hard to breathe. This podcast is for all of us who have supported a child through their diagnosis. It's where we'll come together to share the skills and coping strategies that have made it a little easier for us to breathe down here. But it's also a place for us to connect, to feel heard, to find support, and to swim each other to shore. So, let's dive deep. When you carry me to water,
you carry me away. When I first met Julie, I was struck by her very deep, enduring strength. The kind of an embattled soldier who had seen war many, many times, I knew that she would be the perfect person to talk about the roller coaster of this disease, how totally unpredictable and out of control it can be, and how difficult, I actually think we use the word impossible, it can be to ride and to navigate. I mean, how do you get comfortable knowing that your world could be thrown upside down in an instant? How do you do life? How do you function? How do you buy your child shoes for the next season when you're not even sure they'll be alive to wear them? And that's what I loved and appreciated so much about Julie. She didn't shy away from these questions, and instead she spoke so honestly about her struggles, her anger, and what it feels like to take knock after knock and just keep going against the fiercest storm. Julie's six-year-old son, Carson, was diagnosed with leukemia 4 years ago when he was two, with a rare genetic mutation called the Philadelphia chromosome that makes his treatment more complex. He relapsed during maintenance. He received a bone marrow transplant from his big brother, Reed, as the donor, and it worked. For over 2 years, Carson was cancer-free. And then this past Christmas, literally on Christmas Day, Julie received the devastating news that Carson had relapsed for a second time, catapulting them back into the world they thought was behind them. So behind them, in fact, that Carson barely remembered his first treatment and was now re-entering the cancer world as a very alert, very aware, and very reluctant six-year-old who wanted none of this. Julie and I talk about the armor we wear during our kids' treatment and if it ever feels safe to take it off. She is so honest, and I loved our conversation so much. If you are in relapse right now, or if you feel like everywhere you turn, there's just another blow, another complication, another setback, please take a listen, because Julie is proof that we can survive in uncertainty and that we have more to give than we sometimes believe. Just as an aside, I wanted to mention that I'm really aware that our conversations on this podcast can sometimes come across as, well, sad. You know, when friends ask me about the podcast and if they could listen in and what episode they should listen to, I always feel like I need to preface it by saying, well, yeah, but it might be really sad. And of course, that's for people who are outside of our community, but I'm really trying to protect them from hearing these stories. But I had to stop myself from doing that because, you know, our stories are sad. They are definitely 100% sad and heartbreaking. But what has happened to our kids? That's not our story. Our child's diagnosis isn't our story, nor is their prognosis or what stage they are or the amount of surgeries or rounds of chemo. Our child's cancer is not the story. How we respond to our child's cancer, that's our story. What we do with it, that's what these conversations are about. Because from where I sit and from the many, many conversations I've had with all of you, what we each do with our child's cancer diagnosis is so unique and different and brilliant. And hearing the ways that we each figure out how to do this and how we navigate this, I mean, that's how we learn and grow and connect. That to me is the ultimate definition of support. What we do with our darkness, how we struggle or claw our way towards some slivers of light, these are the stories that help swim us all to shore. So is a podcast about parents who have kids with cancer sad? Yeah, it's totally sad. But this is a podcast about parents who have kids with cancer and what they do with it. And that is not sad. That is actually the most mind-blowingly powerful and life-affirming kind of conversation I think one can have. I have never once left a chat with any parent feeling sad. I should say feeling only sad. Of course, I sit and I grieve right beside you and I feel that pain, but I am also elevated and expanded and ready for more talks just like this because of the endless opportunities we have to learn from each other, learn how to survive and persist through the deepest pain. And I really hope you feel the same. So let's dive deep with Julie. So you continue through treatment and it was rough. Obviously, that first year of treatment is, especially with leukemia, is rough.
Oh, yeah. And we had lots of, you know, he had C. diff a couple days after the Philadelphia. He had VOD, veno-occlusive disease, which is it's bad prognosis. And we got really lucky with that. But yeah, lots of knocks. And you just kind of wonder when things are going to get easier.
When you were in that first year of treatment and all those knocks were coming, do you think because you're already in it that you somehow have this like power to just take the hits? And then it's after, you know, so when Carson started maintenance and things changed a little bit, like treatment wasn't quite as intense and you weren't in frontline anymore. I feel like that's when all of those hits and knocks, that's when you start to look at your body and see these like scars and bruises that you hadn't noticed when they were happening because you don't have time. When your child is continuously being knocked down with, you know, all of these different, reactions to their treatment, you aren't looking at yourself. You're not thinking about yourself at all, but you better believe you're being hit too. You're being knocked down too, just beside your child. Like that's one of the trickiest things about being a cancer parent is that all of the attention and all of the focus is on your child, which of course it should be. I mean, no one in the world is debating that. 100% it needs to be on your child. But because it's your child, you are intrinsically connected to this baby, this person, this soul. Yeah, of course you're getting the same knocks and hits. No, you don't have a port. No, you are not receiving chemotherapy. You are not getting surgeries. No, those are not happening to you, but they kind of are because it's your baby.
I think it's harder than if it's happening to you.
Yeah.
I would rather it happen to me. And I think any parent would say the exact same thing, that they would trade places with their child in a heartbeat. Because watching them suffer through it and having nothing that you can do to make it better is the definition of torture.
I mean, that is a quote of all quotes. It is the definition of torture. You're absolutely right. It is inhumane.
Yeah. Yeah. And I found that because he was so young and he didn't understand the reason behind the treatment, that, you know, it, for me, it made it harder, because you're trying to, you're the person that he trusts most in the world, and you're taking him to this place and you're telling him that these nice people are giving him medicine to make him better. But he's like, I feel okay. But when I leave here, I'm throwing up. Mm-hmm. And you're holding me down while they stick a needle in this painful thing in my side. I mean, he hated his port. And so it's not just the torture of pushing him through treatment, but being the bad guy in that to a child who doesn't understand what's happening to them or the importance of receiving that treatment.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You're put in this role that A, you have zero training for, like zero training. B, you don't want anything to do with. Mm-hmm. And C, yeah, you're the person who is supposed to be saving them, supposed to be keeping them safe, supposed to be, you know, taking them away from scary situations, protecting them from scary situations. And now you're the person who's walking them in the door. And that alone, for a parent to have to endure, is an enormous ask, something that makes my stomach turn even just thinking about it. So when you were going through maintenance, mm-hmm. after that first terrible year, tell me how it felt to slowly transition from being someone with like a full body of armor. For now, that armor didn't need to be quite as intact. It didn't need to be quite as resilient. What did it feel like to slowly take off that armor and see that it really didn't protect you? You really were full of scars and bullet holes, mm-hmm. and every type of, you know, impact you can imagine. It really does pierce through the armor. Who are we kidding?
Yeah. We had a 6-month window between when the main part of treatment ended and when he had his first relapse. And I think during that period, I actually didn't dive too deeply into that spiral. I ran from it. Mm. I ran from it. I went back to work, and I probably wasn't ready to. And I was working in a public-facing job where I had to speak to the public. And I felt a lot of anger at that time. Like, I couldn't relate to people, and people are coming in and they're complaining about having to go to work, or they're complaining about having to be with their kids on a PA day. Oh my God, that was the worst, you know? People that worked for me freaking out over COVID. And I felt like I couldn't relate to people anymore. But yeah, I think during that time, it wasn't a long enough stretch that I fully felt that spiral. For me, that came in the time after the first relapse and after transplant, which made the stakes higher and it was more blows to take. And it was after the transplant that I really, really hit bottom.
I want to say something about transplant with you, because mm-hmm. okay, so you take this little 6-month window where you don't address all of the wounds and the impacts, mm-hmm. but things are going relatively smooth. And again, all of this is in like heavy quotes, because nothing's smooth, but in our context, it was relatively smooth. Relapse happens and your armor just goes right back on. Mm-hmm. Tell me about when you found out your donor wasn't available, and in the span of like 20 minutes, you needed to involve Carson's brother.
we were speaking to the doctors at SickKids who told us, you know, Carson is a white male. There's lots of donors that match him perfectly. So we can do a full unrelated donor with 10 out of 10 match, or we can use his brother, who's a 5 out of 10 match. And I was just like, well, which, you know, which do we do? You know, we're open to both. His brother is more than willing to, but what do you recommend? And the doctors chose the unrelated donor. And I think the main reason behind that was just they, you know, involving a young sibling makes it really difficult if the transplant doesn't work. Yeah. It makes it hard for them to emotionally process. So the doctor chose an unrelated donor. And so we drove to Toronto. My mom and Reed had come because we planned on going to the zoo for the and the CN Tower and doing some tourist things for a couple of days.
How old is Reed at this point?
Reed was 7.
Okay.
So yeah, Reed came with my mom and we were going to do some touristy things. And so he's waiting in the car. It's COVID. Him and my mom are in the car in the parking garage because they can't come into the hospital at that time. And Carson and I go upstairs and our doctor comes in the room and he shuts the door and he said, so we've had something come up. Your donor's been disqualified. So there's a couple of things we can do. You know, we can go back and start screening another donor, but that's time consuming. And time is of the essence. We have to make sure that Carson stays in remission because every time the leukemia comes back, it's a little bit tougher and harder to treat. And so we said we can do that. It might take a month, or we can move on to plan B, which is Carson's brother. And I said, okay, he's in the car. You want me to go get him?
Oh my God.
And he was like, oh, good. Yo, you brought him. Okay. I thought he was back in Ottawa. I'm like, yeah, go get him. And so I rolled Carson in his stroller down back to the parking garage. And my mom's looking at me like, what are you doing? You've been gone for 15 minutes. You know, it was supposed to be a couple hours. And I opened the door and I said, Reed, you're up. We need you to be the donor. And his eyes just bugged out. You could just see the fear in his face. But he was like, okay, all right. And I said, we're going in, we're going to do some blood work. They're going to check you. And he's like, okay, yep, yep. And he unbuckled and he marched
in there. Like, I just, this visual to me is like, I can't even wrap my brain around this. You're in a doctor's mm-hmm. office. Again, you're alone, which I also want to just say, mm-hmm. I noticed so many of us are always alone with our children. Like you're alone at diagnosis. You were alone when you found out about the Philadelphia. You were alone when you found out that the donor didn't pan out. Like these are big, huge chunks of information that you are absorbing mm-hmm. alone. Like let's just start there.
Yeah.
You're now being told that the donor is not available. Oh, okay, don't worry. My son's in the parking garage. I'm going to go get him and bring him up. Like, this is Wild West stuff. And so you go down to the parking garage and Reed unbuckles and is like, okay, let's go. I'm going to donate all of my, like, this is just, you can't make this up. Like the way that we react and the things that we do in these moments of like terror and panic and life-saving, you know, it's so raw to me. I guess that's the word I just think of. Like this is raw stuff. And he unbuckles his seatbelt and mm-hmm. this little 7-year-old says, yeah, you know, let's go save my little brother. And you go upstairs and you start the process, which 5 minutes before Reed was just sitting waiting in the car, like probably mm-hmm. on an iPad. And now all of a sudden he's a donor.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's yeah. such a huge moment for me in your story. I can picture it. I can see it. I'm in the parking garage with you. And it's such a huge, huge moment in your story. So he comes upstairs and mm-hmm. basically starts.
Yep. Yep. He went straight into the cancer clinic. The doctor gave him a full physical examination. He had a nurse practitioner sit down with him and talk about consent and, you know, making sure that he was fit to be the donor. And then we went down to the blood lab, and I think it was like 8 vials of blood that they took from him. And it went from an unknown donor to him in no time.
I love him. I love that he had this like wisdom inside of him to know the enormity of what he was doing.
Yeah.
And so then Carson got his transplant.
He did. Yeah. The cells went from Reed's room. They hooked him up to the apheresis machine. They pulled his cells. They sent them down to the lab. They checked them out, and they came straight back upstairs and went into Carson.
And there you sat watching this happen. I mean, another example of what we endure, what we see. And you would have been, and I wasn't there, but I can tell you, I can see you right now. You would have been stoic. You would have been strong, and you're conditioned now. Like, you are in that world. Mm-hmm. You are in cancer mom mode. If they had asked you to do the transplant yourself, you probably would have. You would have figured out how to do the, you know, you just, you're so deep in it already that nothing is a shock at that point. Nothing is, you just go with the motions. So his body accepted the cells. Mm-hmm. And you have to go through that waiting period to make sure that everything sort of integrates and that it works.
Yeah. Engraftment. Yeah. So that was about 14 days for that to happen, while he sat in the room with absolutely zero neutrophils, like 0.000, nothing.
And you already probably thought all the scariest things had already happened, but now this is yet again another level of terror that you sit by and wait for those neutrophils to start slowly creeping up. But it took 14 days.
Yeah. And the transplant was probably the absolute worst part of this whole thing, because when we go in there, they tell you all of these awful things that can happen. And basically I'm signing a waiver that says, I understand that, you know, there's a 10% chance that my child is never going to walk out of this hospital. And that's a lot.
That's a lot.
That's a lot when you're talking about the life of your child.
But you do it. You sign the papers and you sit and you wait for those 14 days and you just do it. And all of that energy and all of that strength that is being used to sit by and do it, that it's coming from somewhere. And so flip to, we're now past transplant and Carson is essentially, again, we'll put it into heavy quotes, doing much better. And all of that place that you had to pull that energy and that strength from, now it is time to pay it back, essentially. Like, you can't go through the rest of your life with those reserves all empty. So that's how I sort of picture that stage after. So this window opens up where we as parents start to collapse. And I think it's because those reserves are empty and they need to be replenished. But in order to replenish those reserves, we have to heal ourselves. And I mean, where do you start? Where do you even start? Like, the healing process, usually healing starts when you can acknowledge that there has been an impact. When you can make sense of the impact, that's when your healing door opens and you're like, okay, this just happened. I can now start taking baby steps towards healing. But I think for a lot of us, we can't even get to that door. Like, it is like absolute no man's land for a very long time after your child's done their frontline treatment, or the scariest stuff has happened and they're slowly coming back. That's when mm-hmm. we are slowly falling apart.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So let's talk about that time for you. And I'm talking like the early days. This is like before you got into therapy, before you were even able to articulate what was going on inside. Let's talk mm-hmm. about the early days of Carson's kind of Carson on an upswing and you start your downswing.
Sure. So we came home the first week of November, and it was, I mean, I was celebrating too. We were so happy to be home. We had a young puppy that we had gotten, and you know, it was so nice to be back with her, to be back with Reed, to be back, you know, to my own bed. And so I think it was a celebration for a couple weeks, but you know, after that point, I can't go back to work because Carson's immunocompromised. So I'm at home, and it's getting dark at 5 o'clock now because it's November and it's cold outside. Ottawa is freezing in the winter. And I just like, I think all of that quiet time started to get to me. And that's when I started to really think and process what was going on. And at first I was trying to suppress it. I got really big into audiobooks, and I would listen to them at, you know, 1x speed, not enough, because my thoughts would overpower it. I would put it at like 2x speed audiobook, and I would have an AirPod in my ear all day long, washing dishes, doing laundry, taking the dog for a walk, always, because those quiet moments, I could feel the spiral start. And I knew I had to process it. I knew I had to feel those things. I knew I had to think it through. But I couldn't go there at first. So I did my best to cover it up. And it was, you know, I did a relatively good job until Carson's hair started growing back. And he started putting on weight and he started looking good. And I, you know, where you would expect that you'd be celebrating that he's getting back to a normal kid, all I could think is what kept his hair from growing back was what kept the cancer away. And now that his hair is growing back, is there cancer growing in there? Mm-hmm. And we were seen by doctors twice a week at first, and then it went to once a week, and then it went to biweekly, and then it went to once a month. And so, you know, every time we would have blood work, it was reassurance to me that everything was okay. And during those weeks when we didn't have the blood work, I didn't have that reassurance. And that's when I would start to spiral. Oh my God, what if it comes back? How would I ever deal with this? And I think the fear coming back is what kind of drove the spiral mm-hmm. and the processing of all the things. And, you know, it just makes you stop and think, like, what was the last 2 years of my life? Like, what happened? A bomb went off and I am a completely different person and I will never be the same again. And how do I deal with that? And how do I accept that?
Not only will you never be the same again, but you don't yet know who you are mm-hmm. yet as well. Mm-hmm. You're in this liminal stage, this in between that is so dark because you don't have an identity. Plus mm-hmm. you are processing and becoming aware of the pain and the terror and the fear that you have just injured. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is like a seriously dark time for parents. But like we were saying earlier, I felt so much shame around that because there she is, same, her hair starting to grow back. She's gaining weight and I can't be happy about that.
No. And you should be, you feel like you should be. And then you wonder what's wrong with you because you can't feel that.
Yeah. I wish we didn't have to go that dark. But there's this saying that I heard during treatment, and it always kind of stuck with me. And the saying is, if you have to go to hell, don't leave empty-handed. And at the time, was I thinking about all of the, you know, life lessons I was learning down there? Of course not. Of course not. Mm-hmm. But now in retrospect, and I look back to that fetal position time, I actually did bring some things back with me. Did you?
Good and bad, yes. I brought back, I brought back a whole lot of anxiety that I had never experienced in my life before. But I also brought back the ability to not sweat the small stuff.
Yeah.
And I found myself saying to myself a lot, you know, you feel like something is going incredibly wrong, and you remember what you went through, and, you know, how when you were in the hospital dealing with your child who had cancer, like your upstairs toilet leaking through your ceiling was really not a, you'd take that any day over the cancer. And so I would say, like, it's not cancer. It's okay. We'll get through it. And I never had that before. I would always get, like, you know, kind of hot-headed over things that were going wrong and really frustrated. And it helped me let those things go a lot easier because it wasn't cancer. Mm-hmm. And so it would be okay.
But you also brought back a shitload of anxiety.
Crippling anxiety.
I think I remember you saying how buying shoes for the next season was crippling for you because you'd be standing in a shoe store and think to yourself, well, I normally would buy a size up right now, but will Carson be here for that size up? I mean, these are real thoughts that go through our heads.
Yeah. And it's the thought of, like, you know, almost picturing myself next year holding these shoes that would never fit him. And I didn't want to feel that. I didn't want to have those in my house if he wasn't going to be here. Like, how do you make your mind shut that off? And how do you live for today without worrying about tomorrow? It's impossible.
Hi, friends. I'm sorry to interrupt. I wanted to come in here at this point of our conversation because it is so relatable, and I wanted to just sort of paint a picture of Julie's experience learning that Carson has relapsed for a second time. And the reason I want to do that is because we all know this feeling so, so well, and Julie does such an incredible job of sharing what she did with this feeling. So just for some context, 2 years has now passed, and Carson is doing well. He's feeling good. But just this past Christmas morning, actually, Julie shares with me that she logs onto her computer to get instructions to one of the kids' Christmas gifts. And she sees that a notification has come up from Carson's chart that results have come in from a recent test. Okay, we all know that feeling, right? We all know that feeling of when results come in, or when you see unknown caller on your phone, you know it's a hospital, you know it's a doctor, you know that information has come in that could potentially change everyone's life, right? It's a very unique sensation that I think we know very, very well. And sometimes that notification, that email that comes in, it's like a car accident. It's like you don't want to look, but you have to look. And so let's all just picture Julie here. It's Christmas morning. Kids are happy, ecstatic. There's so much joy in the room. And now she has to open up an email from her chart. Now, of course, 2 years have passed, and Julie is assuming that these results will be great. They'll be clear. And instead, they aren't. Julie is now reading that it looks as if a relapse is imminent. And now the real sinking feeling hits. So I want you to imagine this scene for a moment. Julie sitting there trying so hard to maintain the energy in the room, trying so hard to be there for her kids on this joyous day. But she now has information that has completely changed her life. And in the midst of all of this, she needs to absorb the news. And I feel like this realization is such a visceral sensation that we are all now going to be feeling with Julie. So I wanted to highlight this here. Julie also shared with me that once she got that information, she excused herself from the room. She went upstairs and sat on the edge of her bathtub with her laptop and just Googled everything that these results could possibly mean. We have all done this. We have all done this. We have all sat somewhere alone while the world keeps spinning outside. And we have all had that moment of sheer panic, of sheer disbelief that the news that we just received is not what we wanted to hear. So with that feeling at the forefront, let's dip back into our conversation with Julie and hear what she did with this, hear how she processed it.
This relapse, I had finally hit the point where I thought that we were clear. Mm-hmm. I thought, we're okay. We're going to be okay. And when I found out it was back, there was no armor at all. Mm-hmm. I was in shock, but the armor wasn't there. I was angry. I was upset. And, you know, second relapse is no joke. Second relapse is where they kind of say, you know, we'll do our best, but no promises. There's not a clear path forward, and the stakes are really high. And so you're faced with, you know, this terrifying diagnosis, and you've been in this world before. So you know that the stakes are high. You know what this means. You know that your life is about to blow up just when it started feeling normal again. And I was distraught. It was the worst, telling Carson we have to go back to the hospital, we have to stay a couple days. He had no memory of his ordeal before because he was so young. He's mm-hmm. now 6 and a half, and he's like, you know, why do I have to stay? What does that mean? And I said, you have cells in your spinal fluid and they need to give you treatment. And he's like, I don't care about those stupid cells. Like, mm-hmm. I don't want to go. And I was like, but you have to. And so trying to talk to him and trying to pack a bag. And it was probably, I think that topped first diagnosis and first relapse. Mm-hmm. I think it was the worst because I knew exactly what it meant. I knew exactly how scary it was. And things had been so good that I was just, it was so much more devastating to be ripped out of the world that we had created, the life that we created for ourselves post-transplant. It was a really long drive to the hospital. We had moved to a house in the country, so we were a good 45 minutes out, and Adam and I just sat there and didn't say a word. Mm-hmm. I just sat there and we went in and all of the sad looks from the nurses. Mm. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. And I just trying to hold it together. I think that was the first time that I was actively trying to hold back tears, having a hard time not completely breaking down because I was past that feeling of shock and numbness. It was real and it was there. Yeah. It was something else. So we went back into clinic. Child Life came and played with Carson while we went and met with the doctor and our case manager and basically said, you know, we're in contact with sick kids. We don't know what we're doing, but we're talking, we're working on it. You guys are going to stay and be monitored because he has a lot of flasks. We need to kind of see what's going on and make sure he's stable. And so just like that, we were thrown back in. We went from happy, healthy, normal to right back into this world where it felt like we didn't belong anymore.
What has happened since? Like, how have you adapted since? Because this is now a couple months in.
Mm-hmm.
Still, would you use the word distraught? Has anything else sort of layered on top of that?
I think the next day I felt back to my hard exterior. Mm-hmm. And it was planning mode. We met Carson's new doctor. So they had assigned us to a new doctor at CHEO, and she came in on her day off on her holidays to talk to me about, you know, we're going to do CAR T and this is the plan. And so that's kind of when that feeling of, okay, we know what we're doing. I know what I need to do in this. I know what Carson needs to do. I know where we're at, and now we can go forward. So I started feeling better at that point. And I think there was still a lot of anger and a lot of feelings, but I was able to function again and, you know, make these plans.
Didn't you call Tammy or text with Tammy?
Yeah, Tammy had commented on my post that I told our friends that Carson had relapsed, and she reached out to me and said, you know, how are you feeling? And I kind of said, like, I'm so angry and I'm so frustrated and I can't believe this is happening. And she said, don't worry, you're going to wake up tomorrow and it'll be back. You'll be in fight mode. And I was like, yeah, I probably, and I so desperately wanted that feeling. I wanted that to come back because it's a feeling of almost like a comfortable numb. You know, it takes that hurt away. I hate that feeling of just overwhelming grief and stress. And I wanted so desperately to be back in that fight mode. And she was right. The next morning I woke up and we were ready to talk to the doctors and I was back into it.
From where I sit looking at you, this like fully intact, beautiful mom, I am really moved by your endurance and your resiliency. And I don't say that in like a way, like a, you know, yay, you go girl. Like, obviously that's not at all what I mean, because I know you don't want this. And I know that this isn't something you would ever, ever have asked for.
Mm-hmm.
But there is this power that comes with it. Thank you so much, Julie. Thank you so much for your honesty. Thank you so much for this really important conversation about when, if we can ever take our armor off, and what it feels like to think that you're done, that you're out of this life, out of this cancer life, and then what it really feels like to be pulled, yanked right back in. You did such an incredible job of articulating these really deep, hard feelings, and I'm so, so grateful that you were able to. You know, I notice something when I'm speaking with parents who are in treatment versus parents who are out of treatment. There's a different energy. It's not better or worse. Don't get me wrong. It has nothing to do with that. It's a little different. I feel like when I'm speaking with a parent in treatment, that even though I know their language and I can comfortably listen and relate to what they're saying, that there's this protection around them that I know needs to be there. Not a guard that makes parents less vulnerable or relatable, but it's their armor. It's essentially their armor, and I can hear it in their voice. And I come away from these conversations feeling so relieved and grateful that they have it. This armor is not only necessary as we know, but it's also, I really think, a gift from our nervous system. We need it. And I would be so deeply concerned if I didn't feel that a parent had it during treatment. I found Julie so warm and, like I said, so honest, so impressive. I just loved every second of our chat, and I loved it even more listening back at it again because I could hear and feel her strength. And that doesn't mean that there aren't deep wounds. Of course there are, but it means that she's in it and she has all the right intrinsic supports that our bodies and our souls give us when we are in the fight of our lives. Thank you so much, Julie. I adore you. I'm so grateful for you, and I want you to feel all the love and support from this community right beside you and Carson and Reed. Oh my gosh, Reed, the best big brother a kid could have. Please know that we're all here right beside you as you go through this stage of Carson's treatment. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you so much to Ian Blackwood for his beautiful song, Carry Me to Water. Thank you to my friend Kate Mitzi for her logo design. And thank you most of all to my daughter, who has taught me that the deeper you dive into the darkness of the ocean, the more buried treasure you will find. Until next time, that's where you'll find me.